Are you familiar with the arguments that were in support and opposed SB 9 that eliminated single-family zoning? I'm covering them on today's episode.
You're listening to The Andres Segovia Show.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Andres Segovia Show. I am your host, Andres Segovia. Today's episode, I'd like to label it another chapter in my installment series called Debunking Real Estate Myths. The exception is that I have to address two arguments that are being made in support of SB 9, or that made the support for SB 9 for why ultimately it got passage. One is that SB 9 will alleviate the housing affordability and inventory crisis in California, and two, that single-family zoning, therefore single-family homes, is racist. This is going to be one of those episodes where it's not a comfortable topic. Now, anything political are normally reserved for off the record, which you can find at my website, www.theandressegovia.com. It's the exclusive site where you can find everything. Whether it's your podcast-only listeners or following the video platforms, doesn't matter. Everything is funneled over to my website, despite the fact that there's some content that's exclusive to the audio or video platforms. But you can digest all of it at my website. So that's why I always invite people over. In particular, it's because I try to respect other people and always expect that respect in turn, where no one has to be bludgeoned over the head with political opinion and stuff like that. But the mere fact of the matter is that there's stuff that's at play that is political that does affect us eventually. And the arguments used in support of SB 9, it is in my humble opinion that they were disingenuous. So I want to start with the financial part of it before I start talking about the racial aspect of things. So first things first, SB 9 is going to help alleviate the housing affordability and the housing inventory shortage that we have in California. I do not agree that we have an inventory shortage. If anything, we have a lot of units. The affordability part, absolutely. And a lot of things have been done in the name of affordability that have not worked. It's only made matters worse and had made the cost of real estate and housing more expensive. So if those things didn't work, such as rent control, such as accessory dwelling unit laws, why is it then that we're doubling down on those same things by eliminating single family zoning if technically we already tried it? Because the whole argument was for accessory dwelling units is that we don't have enough units. Therefore, let's let people be able to build on their property these ADUs that will legally recognize as some livable spaces, but the lenders won't see it that way. It doesn't matter. The point is we'll be able to have more units so we can alleviate the streets being filled with homeless. And on top of that, we have statewide rent control that was signed into law by AB 1482 just a couple of years ago at this point. Something that none of these arguments address that were either for or against SB 9 that yours truly will cover after I've made my case for why I disagree with SB 9 being the answer. The mere fact that ADUs that have been around for several years that has not resulted in anything, I guess, to the numbers that the state wanted to see to alleviate things, and they ended up pushing to eliminate single family zoning, it doesn't make sense unless there's something more sinister behind it. And there is. I'll get to it. Because building another unit is going to cost a lot more money than it was to do an ADU. I talked about it in the previous episode. An ADU can cost anywhere, to be done right, anywhere from $300,000 to $400,000. That was before the endemic started. Because of inflation, everything across the board is more expensive, from labor to material. And of course, factor in the supply chain issues, delays. So all that being said, I cannot see people being able to rush out to take advantage of this when they have lost a ton of income and in some cases their homes or livelihoods over the past 18 months during this endemic and the riots of 2020 and to some extent 2021, depending on what region they're in. So who can take advantage of this? It's the ones that have the money, and those would be investors. And just recently, I basically paused searching homes for my latest buyer because there's just nothing out there. They're priced out of everywhere they wanted to look at. And I've been looking for 3.5 months for them. And it's sad because this is a buyer that's also grooming for over a year to be ready for this. But every time, I was like, oh my goodness, the more we delay, the more it's getting more expensive. But they were working on the credit, they were working on saving money, and eventually they came about. And the first-time homebuyers, unfortunately, realizing that they're priced out of where they want and where they can afford still is way too far, it wasn't something prudent for them at this time. And I'm really hoping the market will eventually shift to allow them. But with SB9 and other things happening that are peripheral to all this, I do not see that happening for them anytime soon. That's just a matter of fact. That's how much a lot of stuff is changing on the ground. And the intended impact of SB9, based on behavior that's been happening throughout the country, where you might have heard stories about, maybe you heard about BlackRock. This is like the first time anybody's ever heard of them. Like, who the heck is BlackRock? Well, they're an investment company that was buying up real estate instead of investing in stocks to basically have their 401ks and pension funds and all that retirement stuff funded instead of relying on the stocks, right? So that's pretty smart. I actually applaud that. The thing, though, is that normally when I've seen investors buy a property like single family homes, they're just turning it over so they can, you know, make money off the sale and store the profit or whatever, they're going to reinvest it. That's not what's happening. They're instead turning them around to rent. So there's some people that were on the market to be able to buy that spot of the house that BlackRock and other investment companies like them bought out and eventually rented that property out. And some of these that used to be buyers that ended up getting priced out because they couldn't compete against all that cash, they ended up renting where they wanted to buy. The concern has been with investors taking advantage of SB9, or that SB9 will be taking most advantage of by investors, that will create a renter's environment. And yes, I definitely agree with that argument in that sense, because it is happening and it will get worse as we're seeing more and more people being priced out of buying. And that goes into the argument about affordability, because buying is the largest expense that appears in the consumer price index that basically determines affordability. And that is how we affect the prices of housing. Because if these houses are extravagantly priced at this point and people are priced out, they're going to go rent. And if too many people are renting, or where they're going, or where they're at, they have to renegotiate the lease and it's going to be going up every year. Yeah, that has a domino effect. When you're given a choice, like, should I be paying for a mortgage that is cheaper than my rent and gives me tax benefits at the same time, and I could have a place to call my own without concerns of being kicked out in a year if I don't renew a lease or whatever? You know, that sounds amazing, right? You would think. And now it's becoming that much harder, because people that want to follow that dream, they can't. Because like this other buyer and the other buyers that I lost, because they lost all their income during the pandemic, like, well, what then happens to them? And that's really sad. That's why, yes, there's a business component of this that sounds fantastic on SB9, but what doesn't sound good is that now we're going to be creating an environment of renters, and we're not going to have people to be able to have a home to call their own. That's one of the biggest downsides to all this, and ultimately does not solve the affordability issue. You might have more units out there, but if these are investors, even if they're mom and pops that are putting more units on their own property, you think they're going to rent them at cheaper prices? Unless the rest of them, the other property owners, are also bringing down their rent rates, then we'll see. But I don't see that happening. But now let me quickly go over the next one. Single family zoning being racist. That was basically the one that put this over the edge, because SB9 wasn't the first time it was tried to eliminate single family zoning. It's been tried for some time, but now they're using the racial component of it to say, well, see, there it is, that in 1916 in Berkeley, California, that there was a black family that wanted to build a dance hall in a community that was predominantly or all white, and that the community got together with the city council and they created zoning laws. And the zoning laws made it single family zoning exclusive to that neighborhood, that basically outlawed the dance hall because the white people didn't want a black family to have a black dance hall there. And on top of single family zoning, the argument for this history goes that black people only lived in multifamily residentials, so they couldn't even have a building of a multifamily residential in a single family exclusive zoning that was all white people. And that's actually being taught to us brokers through the curriculums that were required for continuing education. This was something never brought up before. It's being brought up now. And I, as a historian, am trying to look at other sources to confirm this. But even Google and, of course, Wikipedia, this is something that I'll take with a grain of salt because anybody can edit Wikipedia. But supposedly, this was the inspiration for single-family zoning for other cities or metropolitan cities throughout the country. Eventually. Now, is that to say, though, because there's implications here, is that for us to infer that single family homes themselves are racist? Look, folks, today in our hyper politicized world, anything is being called racist and people have lost all meaning of words. That's why I can't take this entirely at face value. But I'm yielding the benefit of the doubt to the argument that single-family zoning was used as a means to not let colored people into said neighborhood. And then I agree. Get rid of single-family zoning in its name if that's what you want. Are you going to replace it with something that maybe is more politically correct to still preserve the ability to have single-family or single houses on a lot? Fine, change that nature of that rule. But instead, they threw it all out the window and said, no more single-family homes because the zoning law was racist. Yeah, but building a house on a lot and having your own private yard or whatever, that has been around for centuries. Centuries, since the dawn of man. So what are we arguing here? See, to bring a racial component to it and then make the inferential leap that single-family homes themselves are racist, it flies in the face of common sense. But sense isn't common nowadays. And now we've dealt away with that. So I reject the argument that a home in of it itself, if it's just one sitting on a lot, is therefore racist. If you have issues with the way it was implemented, absolutely. So was a lot of other things. Last I checked, it doesn't matter what skin color you are, how many people want to live in a home with their family and enjoy some privacy of their backyard. I'm not speaking out of turn here. My family has been a victim of racism. We were the first Hispanic family in our block. We were frowned upon by some neighbors and we were embraced by others. That's not to say that, oh, because that one person said this or did this to me, therefore they all are. Because no, I don't judge with a broad brush. Everybody, we are individuals, and in an individual capacity, people should be judged individually. Because if I walked around being prejudiced against everybody, how am I any better than those that were prejudiced against me? So that's where I come from with that line of thinking. No, I wholeheartedly reject that being able to have your own home, to live the American dream, to enjoy a house you can call your own with some kind of privacy, it's not racist. In fact, that is the definition of freedom, to be able to enjoy your rights. And I have long said on my program that our rights begin with our property rights. So this is how I close out all of this, because the proponents and the opponents of SB9 miss something entirely, which is something grander in the grander scheme of it all, for why, yeah, you can have all these arguments, but none of you address the elephant in the room. It's called rent control. It's statewide. And there's cities that have their own rent stabilization ordinance, RSOs. Santa Ana is the latest to join the fray. And normally when Santa Ana wanted to have a discussion to install rent control, they would send out letters to the property owners in Santa Ana, and then there will be a council meeting. Well, this recent one was done in secret, where they adopted the strictest rent control in the state. The reason this is key is because people, when they hear rent control, they only think about a rent cap. Like, you can't raise the rent over more than this, and you're doing it on a schedule. That's not what rent control is. A rent stabilization ordinance has a lot more involved in it. That includes a housing department that has to be created and funded, which is funded by taxes and normally done by property owners. That includes housing inspections by inspectors that are not building inspectors. These are housing inspectors, a lot of whom are activists. They're not certified building inspectors of anything of the sort. They're activists with opinions on how things should be done. And most of the time, that flies in the face of the building code. They don't care. They will show up and issue fines and citations for things that make no sense. And we would then, as property owners, go to the building and safety and like, hey, look, this is what they want. And building and safety would say no. Then the issue has always been that building and safety and the housing departments don't talk to each other. And it's up to the property owner to that's left holding the bag and the problems here not be able to do anything about it. And if you ultimately do not comply with whatever the housing department is requiring of you to use on your own property, they have every right of eminent domain. In other words, taking over your property. They can tell it to not to pay your rent. They can take over your property if you don't comply with every one of the demands. They do inspections every year and surprise inspections on top of that. And you're paying for all of that. And you cannot collect a dime unless you're registered in that city that you have a residential income property. That's what rent control ultimately is. And that is my main concern about all of this, because where rent control technically isn't applied is on single family residents. So single family zones are excluded from statewide rent control or even rent stabilization ordinances. Guess what just went out the window? Now everything is fair game. So long as you start collecting rent on that property on multiple units, now you have the city on your case, and it's not just your property anymore. That's the biggest thing here. And which is why, as I mentioned before, with the first argument about addressing affordability, that it will not alleviate that. Because if you're going to have rents, statewide rent control dictates 5% plus the CPI, whatever that is. That's how much you can raise the rent on an annual basis. Where there are existing rent stabilization ordinances, that means depending on where you are, it could be 1, 2, or 3%. Or in the case of Los Angeles, where there's a moratorium that never seems to end, because Eric Garcetti said as soon as he declares the pandemic over, plus 1 year later, then you can raise your rent. So in other words, it's a moving goalpost of another year from whenever he says it. And it's already been 18 months that you cannot raise the rent on your property. That's what power they're exerting over your private property, over your means and abilities to make a living for yourself. That's how crazy it is. And when they have the power of the housing department on their side to basically enforce it, yeah, you're kind of left holding the bag there. Because there's attorneys that sometimes are assigned to tenants and things like that, that would definitely be on your case. And it's a headache that you're not going to want. So if that's how much they leverage over your property on existing RSOs, if you're making your own residential income property and you're going to be forced to raise the rent at this much on a schedule, you're not going to start at a low rent cost, are you? You're going to charge the highest you can and start from there. Because are these property owners willingly going to operate at a loss? They have to recover the investment already made and the bills that they got to pay almost seems in perpetuity for the building of these multi-family units. That's what nobody argues. So no, it's not going to alleviate the affordability. It's still going to be expensive, even more so, especially when everything's getting more expensive. And when will these units alleviate things if the ADU didn't make a dent, apparently? That is why it is the fact-based opinion of yours truly that SB 9 will not alleviate the housing affordability and inventory crises. Single-family homes can and do alleviate a lot. That's what people want. That's what people have been buying these past 12 months because they didn't want to be held hostage in their apartment. And now a lot of them are finding out they're priced out. They're trying to escape urbanization. But of course, it takes time. So we'll see what things look like in 10, 20 years. But that's the whole point, that a lot of this that goes on is planned way before any of this. Like Agenda 21, 30 years ago. And we're seeing the effects now. These governments have been thinking way ahead. They've been trying to get rent control forever. People keep voting it down. They finally ram it through. They've been trying to take over every single property here in California. They haven't been able to because single family zoning, they found a way to get rid of it and they used the racial component of this to leverage it. And last I checked, every minority that I know, including yours truly, wants or already has their own single-family residence. That might be a relic of things past. And that's it for this episode of the Andres Segovia Show. This has been an installment of Debunking Real Estate Myths. It's basically a twofer. So I hope you enjoyed this latest episode. A lot of the stuff that's usually politically charged is reserved only for off the record, for probably obvious reasons that you've been experiencing here. And because you never know, the gatekeepers of the flow of information normally don't like something that flies in the face of what stances they hold on these political topics. But I'm addressing the financial and policy issues of here in California that I hope others do. And it's on that note that I want to mention also that on the show notes accompanying this episode at www.leadersgover.com, I left resources to a lot of the things that I pulled from, including bill text of SB9 there for you to read it yourself, the full thing, and extrapolate from it what you will. That's it. I've gone long enough on this one. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode. Remember to like, share, and subscribe to the know. And you will be in the know. And I'll see you on the next one.